This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Yo, 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 148, 3 to the 3 to the 6 to the 9, representing the ABQ. What up, biatch? Leave it at the tone.
Well, that's how Aaron Paul used to sound as Jesse Pinkman in the AMC series Breaking Bad. Back then, Jesse was a teenager, cooking and selling meth with his former chemistry teacher, Walter White, played by Bryan Cranston. Both have won Emmys for their performances on the show. In season one, Walt was diagnosed with advanced lung cancer. Needing money for his treatment and wanting to leave money for his family when he died, he decided to start cooking crystal meth, and because of his chemistry background, he cooked super high-quality meth. Jesse, his former flunking student, who was already in the small-time meth business, became Walt's assistant cook. Now, in season four, the two of them are connected to a drug lord and are in way over their heads. A little later, we'll meet Vince Gilligan, the creator of the show. First, we'll hear from Aaron Paul. Before Breaking Bad, he was best known for his performance in the HBO series Big Love. Let's start with a scene from the first season of Breaking Bad, soon after Walt, the chemistry teacher, and Jesse, his former student, have started cooking and selling meth. Jesse was supposed to sell the meth they just cooked and bring back the money. Walt has been waiting for Jesse, who is very late.
We were supposed to start at 3.
Hey, I'm out there making fat stacks, man. Chill. Hey, prepaid cell phone. Use it.
How much is this?
26 big ones.
Is that all? $26,000?
No, that's $2,600. And your share is 13. Minus 25 bucks for that phone.
How much meth did you sell?
Nearly an ounce.
Last time I checked, there were 16 ounces to a pound. What'd you do with the rest? Smoke it?
Yo, I've been out there all night slinging crystal. You think it's cake moving a pound of meth 1/10 at a time?
So why are you selling it in such small quantities? Why don't you just sell the whole pound at once?
To who? What do I look like, Scarface?
This is unacceptable. I am breaking the law here. This return is too little for the risk. I thought you'd be ready for another pound today.
You may know a lot about chemistry, man, but you don't know jack about slinging dope.
Well, I tell you, I know a lack of motivation when I see it.
Oh, my God.
Come on, you've got to be more imaginative, you know? Just think outside the box here. We have to move our product in bulk, wholesale. Now, how do we do that?
What do you mean, to like a distributor?
Yes. Yes, that's what we need. We need a distributor. Now, do you know anyone like that?
Yeah, I mean, I used to, until you killed him.
Aaron Paul, welcome to Fresh Air. I love that scene.
Thank you so much.
And I love the way your former chemistry teacher, who's now your partner cooking meth, is lecturing you about your lack of motivation the way only a teacher could. Now, your character, Jesse, starts off as, I mean, he's a kid from the suburbs who's an underachiever, and he's modeled his look and his way of speaking on hip-hop culture, probably watched a lot of, like, Beastie Boy videos.
Yes, and absolutely.
You get the picture from the cell phone message that we played. Who did you model Jesse on early in the series?
Really, it was a combination of people that I've met throughout my life and people that I have encountered in New Mexico. And it's all over the place. And so I just kind of tried to form a unique, interesting personality through the people that I've encountered.
So we're into the fourth season of Breaking Bad now. Have you come close to counting how many times you've used the word bitch?
Oh, wow. The yos and bitches. It's too many to count. It's incredible. And all of those are scripted. Nothing. A lot of people ask me, do you just improv the yos or the bitches sometimes? And everything's on the page. It's great.
Has it entered into your speech at all, your real speech?
Oh, 100%. Every time we stop shooting a season, it takes me a little bit for me to stop saying yo or bitch. And yeah, it takes me a minute, though.
So your character, Jesse, was supposed to be killed off in the first season of Breaking Bad. How did you find out that your character was doomed? When did you learn that?
I didn't learn that until towards the end of the first season. We were on the sixth episode, so the fifth episode plus the pilot, and we had one more to go, and I hadn't read the script yet. And Vince, we were at lunch, and Vince is...
This is the creator, Vince Gilligan.
Yeah, this is creator Vince Gilligan. Calls me over, and he's, you know, eating with all the writers, and he goes, "I want to tell you something." And I go, "What's that?" And he goes, "You know, originally Jesse was supposed to die at the end of this season." And this is the first time I've ever heard any of this. And instantly, my heart kind of dropped and slowed down a bit. And he goes, "But we don't think we're going to do that anymore." And I was like, "What do you mean? What are you talking about? Like, what's the plan?" And he's like, "No, we just I just want to let you know that that's not the plan anymore." And I didn't know how to take it. But he said that they just love the, you know, the dynamic between Walt and Jesse, and the chemistry that you know, Brian and I kind of brought to these characters. He decided to change the whole dynamic of their relationship, and really of the show. But the entire second season, the entire third season, I thought that Jesse could be a goner at any moment, because there's, you know, many things that this character has screwed up on, and you know, he could definitely meet his deathbed at any moment. So, and they'd always tease me. They'd always joke around saying, "Oh, did you read the next script?" And I would say, "No, not yet. I haven't got it. You know, I haven't got it." And you know, Brian would come up and give me a hug and say, "Well, I'm not going to say anything, but you know, it was such a pleasure working with you. It's been an amazing past year and a half, and you know, you have a huge career ahead of you." And so they would always joke around about it. They kind of slowed down this fourth season, but we'll see. Who knows? I mean, this kid could die at any second.
Well, when I interviewed Vince Gilligan, he basically said he couldn't imagine the series without you.
Oh, I love that man. How nice is he?
But they also made it clear that's no guarantee. So, but you know, that kind of uncertainty, I could see that being a little helpful, because Jesse's never sure how long he's going to live. So
right.
Why should you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's true.
Jesse's changed so much in the course of the now four seasons of the show. And, you know, he starts off really small time. You know, he's almost like still a kid. And now he's involved with this big drug ring, and where there's a lot of violence, a lot of money. At the end of season three, last season, Walt is afraid that the head of the drug ring is going to kill him as soon as Walt has finished training his assistant cook, a man named Gale, in how to prepare the meth recipe. And if the head of the drug ring kills Walt, he'll probably kill Jesse too. So Walt thinks the only hope is to have Jesse kill this assistant meth cook, Gale. So he convinces Jesse that Jesse has to murder the assistant cook. And so you, Jesse, kill Gale, and then you just really become dead inside afterwards. So you kill him, you're dead inside, you start using meth again, and then you end up going to your support group, your drug support group. You want to confess that you've killed a man, but you can't confess that. So you make up a story that you've killed a dog. And here's a clip from that scene in the support group.
A couple weeks back, I killed a dog.
You hit it with your car?
No, I put him down. I watched him go. I was looking them straight in the eye. You know, he didn't know what was happening. He didn't know why. He was just scared, and then he was gone.
And then members of the support group try to comfort Jesse, and one of them says, "Oh, well, the dog was suffering. Putting him down was a kindness." And then when Jesse says, "That's not what happened," the woman of the group assumes, "Oh, well, the dog must have bitten someone, so you did the right thing." And then you say it wasn't that. And then another person in the group assumes, like, well, you must have started using meth again, and that took you to the dark side, because that's what meth does. And everybody's trying to help you justify killing this dog, and you know that there's really no justification for what you've done, which is killing a man. So let's pick up the scene from there, and the leader of the support group speaks first.
How'd you feel about what you did, Jesse? I don't know.
Who cares how you feel? What kind of a person kills a dog for no reason?
Colleen.
You put an ad in the paper, you drop him off at
Colleen.
A shoulder, you don't just sit there and talk about killing a helpless, innocent
Colleen.
Animal.
We're not here to sit in judgment.
Why not? Why not? Maybe she's right. You know, maybe I should have put it in the paper. Maybe I should have done something different. The thing is, if you just do stuff and nothing happens, what's it all mean? What's the point? Oh, right, this whole thing is about self-acceptance.
Kicking the hell out of yourself doesn't give meaning to anything.
So I should stop judging and accept.
To start.
So no matter what I do, hooray for me because I'm a great guy. It's all good. No matter how many dogs I kill, I just what do an inventory and accept. I mean, you back your truck over your own kid and you like accept? What a load of crap.
Hey, Jesse, I know you're in pain.
No, you know what? Why I'm here in the first place is to sell you meth. You're nothing to me but customers. I made you my bitch. You okay with that? Huh? You accept?
No.
About time.
That's my guest Aaron Paul as Jesse Pinkman in a scene from this season of Breaking Bad. You are so lost at this point in the storyline. Do you feel like the character you're playing now is different from the character you started playing on Breaking Bad? Because so much has happened to him. He's changed so much.
Oh, wow, 100%. He is so broken now. I mean, he was a lost kid at the beginning of the series, you know, just kind of struggling to find his way. But he was content with dime bagging it, you know, just selling teens at a time and living in his aunt's house. But when Mr. White comes back into his life and they continue to go down this dark rabbit hole and they can't seem to get out of it. They're both so in way over their heads. And now, you know, Jesse has completely really lost the support of his family. He had lost his first really true love, I think, with Jane. That was started off as a good influence on Jesse, but then just turned into a chemical romance, really. And now, you know, he's a murderer, and he's just lost and tortured, and it's so tragic what he's going through.
And murder really isn't in his nature. But no. He's had to do it, and he has to live with the consequences of that. Did you have to figure out who is Jesse without the drugs and the poses?
Yeah. I really, joining this series, obviously I had no idea where this character was going, and I didn't really have much of a backstory. But as the seasons have gone on, I feel like I have a true grasp of who this kid is, inside and out. And it's incredible how I feel like such a personal connection with Jesse. Feels like he's almost a part of me, to be honest. But I couldn't be such a polar opposite from this kid. But going to work every day and kind of zipping on his skin is such a, you know, such a dream.
What makes you the opposite of Jesse Pinkman?
I feel like I have my life together, really. And Jesse just seems like he's constantly just struggling to keep his head above water. And he's just this, you know, messed up kid trying to find his way. But you know he has this soul. He has this heart. And that's why, I mean, that's why I feel people, you know, are rooting for him, and they just want to, you know, hug him and tell him it's going to be okay. But at the end of the day, like, is it really, is it going to be, you don't know.
He wouldn't accept that hug anyways.
No, he actually would not. No.
You've taken a lot of punishment in the series. You've been beaten in a lot of very imaginative ways. What are some examples of the worst beatings you've taken in the series?
Oh, wow. Well, some of the worst beatings really came at the very beginning, which was done by a character named of Tuco, this guy played by Raymond Cruz. And he's just this very loud, violent drug dealer who's addicted to meth. And there was this one scene where he's beating me up with a bag of money, and beating me to a bloody pulp. And that's the first time Jesse goes to the hospital in the series. And then, the next time that he got beaten up by Tuco, really Tuco's is about to put a shotgun to his face and pull the trigger. And he throws Jesse out of this house. And one of the takes, probably on the eighth or ninth take, my head actually comes into contact with the opening of this wooden screen door. And I catch it, and my entire body flips around, and it splits the screen door into a million pieces, and I just land flat on my like head and chest. And the scene continues to go on because he thinks that I'm just acting, but in reality, I was just completely out of it, and I don't remember it happening. And I ended up getting this pretty serious concussion, and
felt
like, yeah, yeah.
Character thinks you're acting. You mean the actor thinks you were just acting?
Raymond Cruz thought that I was still just in the moment, but then there was a point where he picks me up, puts me on his shoulders, and he was going to slam me against the wall, and I try to grab him and just tell him, you know, to tell him to stop. And so they shut down production for a little bit. Ambulance was called, and they sent me to the hospital. I was saying I was fine, but I just felt a little drunk, to be honest. It was just so strange that it just, you know, ended up going to the ER and spent about 6 or 7 hours with one of our executive producers.
Would you have problems watching scenes like when you're beaten up or scenes when your face has been beaten to a pulp? Do you watch yourself in those scenes?
I do, yeah. I mean, I'll watch it when the show airs, you know, whether it being if I fly home to Idaho and I'm with my family. They'll, you know, they have a Breaking Bad night every week, and so I come from a huge, huge loving family, and they've been supportive since, you know, from day one, and so my parents are, you know, they're still madly in love. It's their 40th anniversary coming up in November, and I have many siblings. I have 14 nieces and nephews, and they throw a huge party. Yeah, they throw a huge party every Sunday night. That's pretty great.
Your co-star. The star of the series, Breaking Bad, is Bryan Cranston. Did you know him from Malcolm in the Middle? I mean, from watching him on Malcolm in the Middle, in which he played the father?
Oh, yeah, I loved him. I loved that show. I thought he was great.
And how old were you when you first started watching that?
Oh, man, I was in L.A. When they were casting that pilot. I remember reading that pilot, and I went out for the older brother, didn't end up getting it, obviously.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah, yeah. Chris Masterson ended up getting the role, and he was brilliant on it. But yeah, I was a huge fan of that show from day one. I think I've probably seen pretty much every episode. But my mom is the biggest Malcolm in the Middle fan. She's obsessed.
Maybe that helped ease the blow that you're going to play somebody who cooks meth in the series.
Yeah, exactly. When I told her that Bryan Cranston was the star of Breaking Bad, the pilot that I had just booked, she lost her mind. She was so excited because she knew one day she would be able to meet him, you know? So she was ecstatic.
So you're obviously very different from the Jesse Pinkman character that you play on Breaking Bad. In fact, you know, he's a meth head. You grew up in Idaho. Your father is a Baptist minister, yes?
Yes, yeah. He's actually retired. He doesn't have a church he does every week anymore, but he still does, you know, weddings and funerals and sometimes will guest speak at some churches. But yeah, throughout my entire life growing up in Idaho, we would go, you know, to his congregation every week, and he would preach. And
what was his preaching like?
It was great. It was inspiring, really. I mean, he would get up in front of all these people and kind of just get lost in the moment as well. And I think that's where I take, not that I'm saying he was really standing up there acting, but he would just really get lost into these stories he would speak. And it was fun to watch and to hear. And, you know, I left at such a young age.
Left Idaho and left home?
Left Idaho, yeah. I left Idaho at 17. You know, I graduated high school a year early and just, you know, the typical story, packed up my car and moved out.
I wonder if there was any pressure on you to be the good kid because you were like the son of the minister. And if so, if acting was a kind of like release valve for that, because you could be all the people that you weren't allowed to be.
Oh yeah, totally. 100%. I mean, you nailed it. I forget who told me this, but they said, you know, acting is really like a cheap form of therapy. It's such a nice release. You know, we're all kind of crazy in our own way. And it's true. It is a nice, it's a great release. And, it's so much fun just to kind of zip on different skins. And
when you left home at age 17, which, as you point out, is really young, did your parents try to like bar the door and do everything in their power to prevent you from going and telling you that you were making a huge mistake that you would always regret, that you were throwing your life away and throwing away everything that they had ever done to help you in life, etc.?
You know what? Not at all. It was quite the opposite. I always had the plan of moving to LA. They knew I always wanted to do this. And I think really in eighth grade, I made it certain, just to let my parents know this was my plan. You know, I'm going to move to like California or New York, and I'm going to try to become an actor. And that they knew that from early on. And so when I started taking it very seriously in high school, and they would see, you know, these productions that we put on, and they'd see how excited I would get about them, they were all about it when I mentioned to them that I wanted to take 0 hour, where I'd go to school early, you know, to do an extra class and take correspondence, which was really homeschooling as well, just to graduate early so I could get out to LA, sooner than later. And they just applauded me and they said, go for it, just do it. You want this. Like, I love your passion. And so they supported me. I love, you know, there's a great story. Most of my teachers were supportive, but there was this one teacher that came up to me when I was saying goodbye, really, because I had graduated, I'm done. And she said, I feel that you're making a big mistake, and what is your plan B? I mean, do you have another plan if this doesn't work out? Like, what if it doesn't work out? And when I told my mom that, because from everywhere I was getting blessings from every side, but I told my mom that, and my mom went straight into the school and just said, "How dare you say this to my son? Like, what's your plan? What's your second plan? What if this doesn't work out for you? You know, what's your plan B?" And it was just so great to see my mom like take that control, because I've never seen her like that in my life. And it was just so great that they were supportive of going after dreams. And because if you don't, then what do you really have? You know, you might as well just shoot for whatever you want to do.
Well, they must have had a lot of faith in you and in your ability to follow through on the dream.
Yeah, no, obviously I couldn't have done this without them. And it's incredible. Very, very blessed.
So you get to L.A. and then what? You don't know anybody there. You don't.
Yeah, no, I know.
You have your car. It's packed up. Then what?
Yeah, I actually, my mom came out with me, found a little studio apartment, and she just wanted to make sure I would get settled. And it's funny, the weekend I was moving into this little tiny studio apartment in North Hollywood, a bank robbery is in progress, like 2 blocks from my place. A giant bank robbery, and it ended in crazy bloodshed. And my mom is like, "Oh my God, where am I allowing my son to move to?" She got on a plane and went back to Idaho and felt, I'm sure, very safe. But I'm sure she was scared for my life, but she was still very, very, very supportive. But yeah, I didn't know anybody. I just, saved up a bunch of money from random jobs I worked in Idaho and just tried to find myself an agent and a manager.
And succeeded?
Yeah.
How did you do it? You just talk them into it or what?
Yeah, I just talked them into it and bribed them a little bit, but I didn't bribe them. I ended up going to this this acting competition that was held downtown Los Angeles, and I mean, there's just thousands of kids there, and I ended up signing with a manager there, and then he found me an agent pretty quickly, a couple weeks later. And that agent, Locke Powell, is now my manager, and I've been with him since day one. And I really owe everything to him. He's great.
Well, you paid off. So, can I just say something about the voice that you do as Jesse?
Yeah.
There's something about the voice that Jesse always seems to be on the verge of, like, complaining or whining or feeling put upon. It's like he's still a teenager, you know what I mean? It's like still his parents are nagging him or his teacher's nagging him. That's his kind of like posture in the world a lot of the time.
Right, yeah. It's true.
Is that what you've been trying for vocally?
Yeah, no, I mean, I see Jesse as this kid that still hasn't found his footing, you know? And I love that, he still calls Walter White Mr. White.
Yeah, yeah, that's so great.
He's just lost in his own world. And I don't know, I think, this season is where he's kind of taking the reins of his life.
Well, I just want to say, if Vince Gilligan is listening, please do not kill off Jesse Pinkman.
Yes, I agree. Thank you so much.
Aaron Paul, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Aaron Paul plays Jesse Pinkman in the AMC series Breaking Bad. Coming up, we talk with the creator of the series, Vince Gilligan. This is Fresh Air. We've been talking about the AMC series Breaking Bad. My guest, Vince Gilligan, is the creator and executive producer of the series. He formerly worked on The X-Files as a writer and co-executive producer. In Breaking Bad, Bryan Cranston stars as Walter White, a chemistry teacher who uses his expertise to cook crystal meth because he needs the money after he's diagnosed with advanced lung cancer. Aaron Paul plays Jesse Pinkman, Walt's former failing student who becomes Walt's assistant cook. Jesse had already been a small-time meth cook and dealer. Now, in season 4, they're both working for a drug lord. Here's another scene from season 1, shortly after Walt and Jesse have started working together. Jesse doesn't yet know why his former teacher is cooking meth.
Tell me why you're doing this. Seriously.
Why do you do it?
Money, mainly.
There you go.
Nah, come on. Man, some straight like you, giant stick up his ass, all of a sudden at age, what, 60, he's just gonna break bad?
I'm 50.
It's weird, is all, okay? It doesn't compute. Listen, if you've gone crazy or something, I mean, if you've gone crazy or depressed, I'm just saying. That's something I need to know about, okay? I mean, that affects me.
Well, Vince Gilligan, welcome to Fresh Air. In the scene we just heard, Jesse asked the question that you, the creator of the show, had to answer, which is, why would a straight-laced chemistry teacher start cooking meth? How did you come up with the storyline of the chemistry teacher who, faced with probably terminal cancer, starts cooking meth to support his family, to have money for them when he dies, and to cover his own medical expenses?
Well, thank you for having me. I'm not sure where the idea for the show came from. I remember the exact moment in which the idea hit me, but as to where the idea came from, I'm not quite sure. I suspect it had something to do with the fact that I was, when I came up with the idea for Breaking Bad, I was about to turn 40 years old, and perhaps I was thinking in terms of, you know, an impending midlife crisis. And to that end, I think Walter White, at least in the early seasons of Breaking Bad, is a man who's suffering from perhaps the world's worst midlife crisis. And although, actually, to be accurate, I suppose in the first episode he finds out it's more of an end-of-life crisis than a midlife crisis. But maybe that's what was inspiring me.
Well, you know, the implication in Breaking Bad is that if you got a medical death sentence, that you would have the potential of totally changing your life and your personality and doing things you never would have dreamed of doing before. Have you asked yourself that question, whether if you got a diagnosis like Walt gets at the beginning of lung cancer, if you would become a different person?
I have asked myself that question a lot, and I certainly would hope, and I assume I would not do anything illegal like Walt does. But
heck no,
heck no. There's a time honored. It's a time honored story. In fact, in some sense, the Kurosawa movie Ikiru, if I'm pronouncing that right, and my apologies to Japanese speaking listeners if I'm butchering it. But there's a wonderful Kurosawa movie from the 50s in which a man, mid-level, very much a Walter White type, or rather Walter White, I suppose, inspired by this man. This man is very much a mid-level corporate guy who finds out he's dying of cancer. And in the last months of his life, what he chooses to do is a very good thing. It's to build a playground, a small playground in Tokyo for the children in his neighborhood. And this haunting ending of this movie is this man swinging on a swing set in this playground that he's managed to build after a surprisingly hard go of it. And the snow is coming down and he's singing a Japanese children's song. And it's just haunting and beautiful. And of course, Breaking Bad is anything but that. It's the flip side of that. It's a man doing terrible things once he is freed by this knowledge that he does not have long for this world. But I think what the two stories share, in a sense, is the idea that if we found out the exact expiration date on our lives, if we found out when we were going to be checking out, would that free us up to do bold and courageous things, either good or bad things, hopefully good things? And I think there's a lot of that involved in Breaking Bad.
Early in the series, Walt, the chemistry teacher, and Jesse, the meth head, have to kill a couple of meth distributors who have been trying to kill them. And one of these guys is still alive after the attack, so they take him to Jesse's basement, chain him up, and then have to figure out what to do with him. And Walt is torn between his instincts of wanting to help this, like, suffering man who's, like, wounded and maybe dying and hungry and thirsty. He's torn between wanting to help him and wanting to kill him. Killing is not in Walt's nature, at least not yet. And he makes a list of reasons why he should let this man live and reasons why he should kill him. And I want to read that list. Under let him live, he writes, it's the moral thing to do. Won't be able to live with yourself. He may listen to reason. Murder is wrong, exclamation point. Judeo-Christian principles, you are not a murderer. Then under reasons to kill him, there's only one reason. He'll kill your entire family if you let him go. And so Walt kills him. But I love the idea of Walt being such like a reasonable man, such a kind of studious man, that he'd make a list. Were you in on writing that scene?
Oh yeah, no, I wrote that episode. Yeah, I was. that was a fun list to make up. That was the one I particularly liked was Judeo-Christian principles.
So why did you see Walt as like, here's the kind of man who, even faced with like this man who he has to kill is in the basement, he's going to make a list.
He is that to me. That is the heart of the show. This is a man. It's very much a fish out of water story. And unlike Tony Soprano, who is a character, a man who is born into a life of crime. The Sopranos, by the way, a great inspiration and a wonderful, goes without saying, wonderful television show. But where we obviously steer a different path is that for a TV show like The Sopranos, those are people born into a life of crime. And Walter White is a man, on the other hand, who makes this active decision, who makes the decision to become a criminal, to become a villain. And as one might expect, when someone embarks upon a whole new way of thinking, a whole new way of behaving, there are stutter steps and there are mistakes made. And a lot of those early episodes in particular involve Walt bringing his old world and the way he would make decisions and the way he would come to conclusions in a scientific fashion, you know, from his whole life, bringing those ways of thinking and those ways of behaving into this new life. And of course that leads to moments of awkwardness and comedy.
So in the first season, Walt is really not a killer, but he's kind of forced to kill or else be killed. But as time goes on, he kind of becomes a killer. He kills again. He orders killings. I mean, he becomes a really bad man. And
yes.
I want to play another clip. In this scene, his wife, Skylar, who's played by Anna Gunn, she knows that he's cooking meth and that he makes a lot of money, although she has no idea yet quite how much money. And she knows he's in danger. And she thinks, she's trying to convince him he should go to the police and explain that he's a good man. He got into the meth business because he was dying. He needed money for his family. He meant well. He's not really a bad guy. And this is the scene.
I've said it before. If you are in danger, we go to the police.
Oh, no, I don't want to hear about the police.
I do not say that lightly. I know what it could do to this family, but if it's the only real choice we have, if it's either that or you getting shot when you open your front door,
I don't want to hear about the police.
You're not some hardened criminal, Walt. You are in over your head. No. That's what we tell them. That's the truth.
No, it's not the truth.
Of course it is. School teacher, cancer, desperate for money.
Okay, we're done here.
Roped into working for, unable to even quit. You told me that yourself, Walt. Jesus, what was I thinking? Walt, please, let's both of us stop trying to justify this whole thing and admit you're in danger.
Who are you talking to right now? Who is it you think you see? Do you know how much I make a year? I mean, even if I told you, you wouldn't believe it. Do you know what would happen if I suddenly decided to stop going into work? A business big enough that it could be listed on the NASDAQ goes belly up. Disappears. It ceases to exist without me. No, you clearly don't know who you're talking to, so let me clue you in. I am not in danger, Skylar. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot, and you think that of me? No. I am the one who knocks.
Wow. Very, very chilling scene. And the best example of how Walt's changed, although Walt is a little delusional because he's in great danger. He's not only the one who knocks, he's the one who's in danger of getting knocked off.
Yes.
But you've said in the past that you see Breaking Bad as an experiment to see if you can take a Mr. Chips teacher kind of character and turn him into Scarface. Done. I mean, you know, Walt has really become a bad man. He's a killer. Once you accomplish that feat of turning Mr. Chips into Scarface, did you have to figure out what next? Now what do I do?
That's a very good question, and we have 16 more episodes in season 5 in which to discover that. But this show very much was something of an experiment, and I thought it might be fun or interesting to try to play with the idea of a character who, you know, a more dynamic interpretation of that, in which a character not only changes throughout the lifetime of the series, but that is sort of the desired point of the series, that the character starts off as a protagonist and gradually becomes the antagonist. I guess part of the answer to your question is, how much darker can Walt get? Is his journey complete as of this point, his journey on that arc of from good guy to bad guy? So it's a tricky thing to answer.
In a New York Times article about you, you were quoted as saying that you found atheism just as hard to get your head around as fundamental Christianity. And you said, because if there's no such thing as cosmic justice, what is the point of being good? That's the one thing that no one has ever explained to me. Why shouldn't I go rob a bank, especially if I'm smart enough to get away with it? What's stopping me? That could be Walt talking. And nothing's stopping Walt right now. He's doing all kinds of bad things. But if you think that you need God to stop you from doing something like robbing a bank, and if God is no longer in your life, what's stopping you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty much, I suppose, I was raised Catholic. I'm pretty much at this point agnostic. I have no lock on the truth. I don't feel like any of us do. And I when it comes to you know, questions of spirituality, I'd like to believe that there's more than just us in this universe. I can't prove it to be true. I don't know that it's true, but I'd like to believe it, because the alternative is that all we're left with, alternatively, is that each man and woman to their own philosophy and their own code of ethics, and I don't see that there would be in that kind of a universe any kind of unifying reason to be good. I'm not saying that if suddenly it was proven to everyone's satisfaction that there was no God, there was no ultimate point to it all, I don't think suddenly everyone would start robbing banks, nor should they, God knows. But it's just one of those things you find yourself wondering about at 3 in the morning when you're lying awake, unable to sleep, you know, what's the point to it all? And it's funny, my girlfriend of 20 years has a great line that I always quote. She says, I can stand the thought that there's no heaven, but I don't know that I can stand the thought that there's no hell, because, you know, where is Hitler then? You know, where is Pol Pot? There's got to be some kind of a payback. I'm not saying there is, and I don't think she is either, but we tend to want to believe that there is. I got to believe there's some kind of karma, there's some kind of payback, there's some kind of, I got to believe the wheel turns for everybody who does, you know, truly horrible deeds. I got to believe some cosmic wheel of justice on some huge and subtle and intricate level turns. And
let me just ask you, does this sense of like this karmic wheel turning, is that a clue, do you think, about how Breaking Bad is going to end? Because if people need to be punished, there's a lot of people in the series who need punishment.
And yes, Walter White probably first amongst them. It's interesting. Probably a casual viewer to the show might think that it's a show about immorality or amorality, and I suppose in a sense it's not. I the things that Walt does, probably he does need to atone for, and perhaps he will when it's all said and done.
Okay, I'll accept that as maybe a clue. though I realize you have no idea where it's going yet, so I won't accept it as too much of a clue.
It's sort of like with life. I have my desires for it. It doesn't mean that we'll necessarily be able to get there.
Well, Vince Gilligan, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I really enjoyed it.
Vince Gilligan is the creator and executive producer of Breaking Bad. You can hear an interview that the series star Bryan Cranston recorded with our TV critic David Bianculli on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, and Heidi Simon. I'm Terry Gross.
La ciudad se llama Duk, Nuevo México el estado. Entre la gente mafiosa, su fama se ha propagado, causa de una nueva droga que los gringos han creado.